Roger Hines is a name that's come up a number of times on this show recently, so I figured that this was the time that we should interview the man himself, strike while the iron's hot, as he's just come off of two wins at the Icons of Foam shaping competition at the Boardroom Show. And Roger's been involved with and worked alongside the most well-known board builders in the industry, starting in California and Hawaii in the early 70s, through Japan, Brazil, and today back in California. All of his peers regard Roger as one of the most talented craftsmen in surfboard building. But Roger's story has never really been captured. He doesn't have an entry on the Encyclopedia of Surfing. There's been no real big profile pieces in any of the mainstream magazines. He's just quietly maintained his focus on building surfboards for the last 40 years. In an era of shameless self-promotion, Roger is the anti-hero. He reluctantly Instagrams, but he doesn't have a Facebook nor a Twitter account. He just quietly toils away, basically, building surfboards from beginning to end with one pair of hands, as he likes to say. 7 days a week. Roger and his wife, Christy, are the only workers in his 2,000 square foot factory. There's one shaping bay, one sanding room, both occupied by Roger, and there's six laminating racks. He's in his early 60s, and his workday often starts at 4 a.m. He really could easily staff his factory with young shapers and glassers who are just eager to glean some of his wisdom, but he doesn't. He's a perfectionist. Quality is paramount at Roger Hines Surfboards, and the only person's work whose quality is consistently and sufficiently high is Roger's. It's a niche in the market that Roger is happy to fulfill. It means he doesn't have to meet high volume demands, and he can kind of cherry pick his work, and his clients largely allow him to build what he desires. Roger's name has recently bubbled into the public's awareness outside of the core of the industry, just due to him winning this Icons of Foam shaping competition for the second year in a row. And in this competition, the competitors had 90 minutes to recreate a classic 1984 Aki model Rusty Thruster. Rusty himself, along with his son Clint, judged the final boards, and he deemed Roger the winner. Handily. So we will get to that point in the story a little bit later, but let's begin at the beginning of Roger's timeline in Southern California in the late 60s. This is David Scales. Welcome to Surf Splendor.
I was born in Ventura and I grew up in Paramount, which is inland Lakewood, Long Beach area. I started surfing in 66. When I was 12 years old.
Okay.
And
were your parents just drive you to the beach, or?
No, actually, my grandparents had a place down in Newport Beach, down by Blackie's area, and that was actually the first place I surfed. I didn't know it as Blackie's at the time, but it was Newport Pier on the north side, and I tried to haul out some 9 or 10 foot board that was twice as big as me. And,
what was your awareness of surfing at the time? Was it in, like, mainstream media?
My older brother was surfers, and then they got shot off to Vietnam, and so that's kind of got me going.
Oh, okay.
They started surfing in the early 60s.
Okay. So they left their boards and stuff behind?
Yeah, there was that was just a treasure trove of boards in the mid to late 60s. Everybody was gone.
Okay.
And, I mean, they were everywhere. And that was at the time... 68 was when the boards were being chopped down in size really quick. I mean, overnight, 1.5, 2 feet off the board.
Okay.
So a couple of friends of mine from school at the time thought it would be a good idea to grab up some of these boards and see what we could do with them.
Okay.
And that was kind of the start of it, just stripping them down and getting going.
That was the start of your surfboard construction career, basically?
Well,
or deconstruction, I guess.
Yeah, just taking taking them apart and putting them back together. But it was definitely a learning curve because of you weren't invited into people's factories at the time to see what was going on, and there was no internet to where you could go on YouTube and right. find out how to laminate a board or do a cut lap that was worth a shit.
Right.
And so it was pretty bad at best.
Okay. The boards were?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were horrible. I'm sure of it. I don't remember, but...
What board were you riding? Talking about that Blackie's experience, do you remember?
Yeah, the first board I got was... I bought it from a guy in Paramount for $25, and it ended up... I went to school with him, a guy named Alan Zamboni, who his father or grandfather invented the ice rink machine. They lived down the street from me.
No way.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
That's a piece of history.
Yeah.
Had the machine already been invented at that time? Like, was he wealthy at that time? Or
no, we were all pretty poor.
Okay.
We lived in a pretty poor area. I don't know. I assume it wasn't invented at the time. I had no knowledge of it.
Yeah.
But I believe it was a Harbor Banana.
I
think
really?
I bought it for $25.
Really?
Yeah. I believe that's what it was.
Is that the one that you ultimately ended up cutting down?
No. No. I don't remember where that one ended up. I think, I tell you the truth, I don't remember what the ones were that we started on. But we were pretty stupid because we got into a board one day and started peeling it apart, and man, this thing is hard. It ended up being a wood board. You know, a lot of boards were colored.
Oh.
So you couldn't tell. They should have been a flag when the board weighed, 60 pounds.
Right.
Probably would have. Pretty stupid though.
Yeah.
But I remember trying to do a really wide V bottom the first couple, that type of thing, transition board.
Yeah.
I don't remember what size they were. It was pretty primitive at best.
Talking about there wasn't a lot of information out there to follow the mechanics of actually how to build or deconstruct a board. There's also probably no information about board design. You know, talking about a V bottom or whatever else you might be trying to build. What was your understanding of kind of the hydrodynamic principles of board design?
Nothing.
Okay. So what would you try to build? What goal are you trying to achieve?
I would see something that was being built by a manufacturer, and I would think, well, let's give that a try.
Okay. So it's just trial, take it out in the water, ride it, and then see how it works, basically?
Yeah.
Wow.
None of us were very accomplished surfers at the time, so if it went straight to the beach,
right.
That was pretty much an achievement.
Okay. When I did that interview with Malcolm Campbell, he was talking about... I was under the impression that like a better surfer will give you better feedback on a board, but he said it's kind of the opposite, where he and his brother weren't that great of surfers, so if there was an improvement in the board, it mattered drastically to them. Like, they would see that effect really significantly.
Yeah, you know? No, I can see that. Over the years, I'm not an accomplished surfer by any means, but I could feel how the board went through the water,
mm-hmm.
and I could tell what the differences were. I knew what worked for me, but I was able to make some boards for some really good surfers through my career that brought back some really good feedback.
Yeah, that feedback also helps.
Yeah.
In addition to riding it. Where were you surfing at that time when you first started building boards? We're in the late 60s. You talked about Blackies. What was the scene like in Southern California? What were the beaches like? Where were you surfing?
I think it was probably Bolsa Chica, which at that time was called Tin Can Beach.
Okay.
And it was just a wide open sand beach that you'd had to park on Pacific Coast Highway, so you couldn't see the waves. There was no parking spots or anything, and it was pretty abandoned during that time, and you could go there and surf.
Why did they call it Tin Can Beach?
Don't know. That's what it was called, though. Okay. Probably because it had a crap load of tin cans on it, I would imagine.
Yeah.
It was, that was what it was called, though. And then the cliff area, which was called Five Wells at the time, because there was five oil wells up on top.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, there was no parking spots along there, no lots anyway, to where you could just have your run of it.
Yeah.
It was pretty wide open. I think the name spots, the pier and river jetty and all that, were pretty crowded.
Okay.
Well, crowded for that time, which is nothing.
What were the waves any different back then, or are the spots still kind of the same today?
Yeah, I don't think it's changed much. I remember before I went to Hawaii in late 71, I remember surfing out at the river jetty, and there was a pier there, and it was to load machinery and stuff like that. So there was a pier at river jetty proper there, and so that would break up the swells. There would be some pretty good saw swells that would come through, and that would break it up, and that later was taken apart.
What happened to it?
They just chopped it off and under the ocean.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've never seen that. So you talked about going to Hawaii in 71. What was the reasoning behind that?
I wanted to surf, and I had every interest in going to Hawaii and surfing. And I went over there with a friend the first time, and we camped out at Poina Point by Haleiwa. And we were there for, I think, 6 months. It must have got there in late 71, November, December. But
I
took a board. Yeah, we
camped for 6 months straight.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
There were showers right there at Haleiwa.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, back then, there wasn't a lot of people on the North Shore compared to what it is now. And if you just kind of stayed under the radar, you were fine.
Okay.
If you were looking for trouble, you were definitely going to find it.
Sure. Prior to getting to Hawaii, you were building boards. Is that how you were making a living?
No. Prior to going to Hawaii, I wasn't making boards for a living. I was just doing whatever I could, jobs to get to Hawaii.
Okay.
No, I wasn't building boards. But when I got to Hawaii, I'd actually taken a board with me that I had made here. But I got there and wrote it a few times and realized that I needed to change up a bit. So I went into, I think there was a list of phone numbers at Country Surf Boards of boards for sale, that type of thing. And I ended up getting an 8-something Jim Turner, who was really famous at the time.
I don't know his name at all.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm naive, but
you know, if you had a Turner gun in the early 70s on the North Shore, you were crapping in tall cotton. He was a great shaper, Plastic Fantastic.
I know Plastic Fantastic. Yeah. Okay.
And it's funny because later on in life, Jim and I have become great friends.
Really?
Yeah. He lives on Kauai now. Yeah, so I had that board and I rode it into the dirt. But during that first stay, I was there with a friend who actually ran into one of the shapers who worked at Country at the time, named Leroy Dennis, and he wanted to have him shape him a board. So I went over there and was watching him shape a board, and it was one evening at Country, and somebody was in there glassing, and it was like a light went on.
Hmm.
You finally got a chance to watch somebody work, and it was just like, holy mackerel. Everything started to connect the dots at that point. Glassing a surfboard is just a procedure.
Okay.
I start in the same place. I finish in the same place every time. It might be different for somebody else, but when I glass a surfboard, I don't care what it is. It's a procedure to me.
Mm.
I look at the temperature, I catalyze it, and I go like hell.
Okay.
There's
no creative expression in glassing.
Well, there's definitely, when you're doing abstracts or artsy style boards like that, yeah, you definitely slow it down a bit. But as far as just glassing a 10-foot red gun or a 6-foot clear sand finish, to me, it's just a procedure.
Okay. I'm a living on a easy, on a bottle of
whiskey. I have no money. Roger had been camping in Hawaii for 6 months in the early 70s, but he hadn't been working. Through that initial experience at Country Surfboards, Roger saw an opportunity to turn his vacation into, perhaps, a way of life. But prior to that, he was just living off the money he had earned in California, doing odd jobs.
If you went to the North Shore in 71 with $1,000, you could stay the whole year.
Do you keep your money in a bank, or do you keep it on you? I mean, how does that work?
I'm trying to think how we did that. I think we took traveler's checks. Yeah, we took traveler's checks.
Okay. So there's a little bit of security there.
Like I said, if you flew under the radar, nobody was there to bother you.
Okay.
It was the North Shore.
Yeah.
It was a perfect place to be in that time. Vietnam was just getting over, and everybody was just happy to be anywhere.
Who were you surfing with around that time? Was
I mean, the first time out at Sunset Beach, it was like all these guys who had been in the magazines, all of a sudden they're dropping in and you're paddling by. It's pretty pretty nice experience.
Who do you remember being impressed by?
Jesus, everybody. Right. Everybody. First time out at Sunset, I think. I remember Sam Hawk being out there and Reno, the iCows. I don't know, everybody, Rarick. I mean, anybody who was anybody was surfing out there, and it was fantastic.
How did it feel being a Californian and being used to California waves and then paddling out of a place like that? Was it as intimidating as one might imagine?
Yeah, yeah.
And with those personalities in the water too, what's your approach? You just kind of sit on the shoulder?
I just kind of stayed out of the way.
Okay.
And I just kind of stayed out of the way and then just jumped in there whenever there was a free one available. And, mm-hmm. But yeah, it wasn't intimidating to watch them, or they didn't make it intimidating to me, because there must have been another 50 guys out there just like me.
Okay.
But it was great to be part of the show. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful experience to be out there for the first couple of times, just going, wow, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And then you get mowed over by an 8-foot West Peak, and then everything snaps back into reality.
Yeah. So you find yourself at Country Surfboards, seeing a board being built, and you kind of recognize that light bulb moment and your life's going to change direction.
Yeah. Yeah, at that point it was just, I have to be in Hawaii. And
were you planning on going home prior to that?
Yeah, by that time money was getting a little low, so it was time to go.
Okay.
But for the life of me, I came back here, and I don't know what I did for work, probably construction or something, to earn enough money to get back over there. And then when I got there, made a run at it again, and this time got into a house with a friend who I knew from over here, who was a photographer.
Okay.
And he actually shot some, he was just finishing up his military stint, and he was part-time photographer, I believe it was for Surfing Magazine, Gary Terrell.
Okay.
So I grabbed a room at his place, and there it was. I just went off and found some work, working construction, and then working with boards whenever it was available.
Hines started at the bottom of the totem pole. Dick Brewer and Lightning Bolt were the two big labels on the North Shore at the time, but they also had worldwide demand. There were plenty of other talented craftsmen on the North Shore, some of whom would moonlight for those brands, but the only way to learn surfboard construction was through hands-on experience.
You know, the whole Lightning Bolt thing was genius. They brought in, under one umbrella, the best shapers and glassers. And it was amazing, the quality of board that was there. I know before that, the whole Surfline thing was doing well. They had a lot of boards coming from Surfline that was really high quality. But the Lightning Bolt thing, yeah, they had a whole roster of guys that were just incredible. I had access to Kent Smith. I had access to a couple different guys, Jeff Edwards, Ed Angulo.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole deal with the Lightning Bolt thing, they really built a lot of nice boards.
Yeah.
It was pretty incredible. The word factory on the North Shore was kind of a loose term at that time, because
okay.
If you had a garage with one down rack, you were definitely a big deal.
Okay.
There was a lot of people to draw from over there. There wasn't a place that I had to show up every day and do anything. There was a lot of people to draw from. Kent Smith, who had a place down by the pipeline with a guy named Jeff Edwards. I learned a lot watching that go on. Just really, again, in a garage. It was amazing, the work that came out of places like that.
Yeah.
And I know there was guys, in Covella Bay, there was guys building glass and a lot of boards down there. Steve Cranston, Steve Sales, who actually works for Fiberglass Hawaii now.
Yeah.
Sandra, back then.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small community of guys just building boards. I had no ambition. I wanted to be there to surf. This was a means to buy food and pay rent.
Okay.
And when that would dry up, because most of the boards would be built during the winter months.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the summer months, you'd go work construction.
Mm-hmm.
So you just, at that time, I had no ambition. I was just there to surf.
Okay.
I didn't want to do anything, actually, other than surf and just pay my bills.
Well, it seems like you said, though, it was kind of a light bulb moment. So was there any, I would think there's a little bit of a passion for the building process. Or is it just a means to an end?
It was a light bulb moment because I had nothing to draw from when I first started deconstructing and putting them back together. There would be somebody you could ask, hey, what, you know, you've seen this done. But when once you saw it done in person a couple times, you understood, okay, this is the benchmark right here. You want to start and just go and get better and better.
Right.
No, I really did. There was, you know, there was no, I didn't really have any ambition at that time to be a surfboard builder or a construction worker. It was just whatever it was to pay the bills, I did.
And surf as often as possible.
Every damn day.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great time to be out on the North Shore.
Yeah, it seems like it. It's like a golden era.
You were looking for people to surf with most of the time.
Really?
Well, not at some of the big name spots, but you could surf the out-of-the-way places pretty much by yourself.
So you're actually looking for companions to paddle out with?
Yeah.
That's a crazy concept in Southern California. It's the exact opposite nowadays.
As Roger's work experience grew, so did his reputation for quality and attention to detail. He also spent so much time in the water that he found himself sharing waves with and eventually building boards for some of Hawaii's finest surfers.
I've made boards for a few guys that were pretty instrumental. Jock Sutherland, who obviously is a very accomplished surfer, who liked the boards, and we did real well together. And then Mike Armstrong, who's no slouch,
mm-hmm.
at a place called The Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been best friends for a lifetime, and he still rides the boards to this day. Yeah.
Talking about Pipeline, what was your first experience with that wave?
Well, I was never accomplished out there at best. I you know, some of the smaller days.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty uncrowded. On the smaller days, nobody would really care about it.
And how small are we talking?
Yeah, like 5, 6, 8 feet, something like that.
Like head high, at least?
Yeah, ceiling high, whatever.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I ran into the bottom out there a couple times. That wasn't pleasant.
No. Did you sustain any injuries or stories?
Oh, yeah. No, I've got cuts and bruises. I think I have 25 stitches on my chin and 5 front teeth that were gone out of one face first adventure.
No way. Is it a right or a left?
You know, it was a right, and I know that Michelle Genode lived at the Pipeline at the time. Him and I were friends. And when I hit the bottom, I was kind of, how bad is it? And I remember Michelle had a big glass window at his house, so I ran up just straight up the sand and looked in the window, and I went, yeah, that's not good. And I forget who was there, one of the other guys who surfed out there. And he ran me down to Kahuku and got stitched up and got some caps on my teeth and off I went.
I mean, before you even get up to Michelle's house, you feel with your tongue that your teeth are missing probably, so that's not a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everybody got lumps and bruises over there back then.
Yeah.
I'm sure they still do. It was just part of it. You know, you're going to get hurt playing sports, you're going to get hurt.
Yeah.
Doing whatever you do, if you do it often enough.
Right.
Roger mentioned that his first board building epiphany came at Country Surfboards. Things came full circle later in his career, as he now carries the Country Surfboards license and still makes plenty of boards under that iconic label.
What I know is that it started in the late 60s, and Mike Horak and Mike Turkington, and I believe Bill Stonebreaker was in on that too. They kind of opened a shop there in Haleiwa. And I remember my first time there, they sold some brewers out of there and some Chuck Dents because of Barry Kanayapuni was shaping for Chuck Dent at the time. I remember one time going through Haleiwa and seeing Al Chapman asleep on the hood of the car. And he had these big brown leather boots on. Like, I don't know what they were. And he was just passed out on the hood of the car. It was 100 degrees outside.
Just leather boots and like trunks or something?
Yeah. It stuck in my head that, wow, it's the North Shore.
Yeah.
But,
the Wild West, man.
It was. There was no police out there at that time.
Yeah.
You got away with whatever you wanted.
Right.
I never really had a problem out of all the years I was over there. I never really had a problem with the locals or whoever was there because I kind of flew under the radar and I didn't think for a moment that anything there belonged to me.
Oh, okay.
I didn't think that the waves were mine. I didn't think that the land or anything. I was there visiting mm-hmm. no matter how long I was there, and I was there probably longer than most.
Mm-hmm.
I was just visiting, and so I got along real well. I didn't have problems. I also know that you didn't go down to Cammie's Market on a Friday night after dark because you were probably going to run into some trouble if you did that.
Mm-hmm.
But
when you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
What do you think that is the problem that people get into on the North Shore then? Is that they show up and expect a little bit of, I don't know, ownership?
Back then it was different. I think when I go there now and for the last 20 years, I kind of stay and surf down in the Sunset area with Randy, and I don't venture out much, so most of the guys I'm surfing with, I knew 40 years ago.
Right.
So it's not a problem. Back then, though, I think there was some guys that came over that probably had some high expectations that had to be, you know, simmered down a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the busting down the door story that's been told and documented a lot, I mean, seems to really represent that.
Yeah, the time when they were trying to make a living out of surfing.
Right.
I remember I was on the beach at the first Pipeline Masters, and I think Army came in second place, and I think he got like $100 or some shit like that. And
crazy.
And
so who won?
Jeff Hackman.
Got it.
And now I think the guys just are getting picked to get in it. I don't know how much they make.
Yeah.
A lot.
Even last place, it's like probably $8,000 or something.
Yeah, so yeah. It was a little skewed.
That's funny.
But No, you kind of knew who to stay away from.
Okay.
Even now, if I go there, I kind of know who to stay away from.
Mm-hmm.
If you go anywhere, pick a spot, go to Huntington Pier.
Mm-hmm.
You got to know who to stay away from.
Yeah. Well, in the surf world, yeah, Huntington Pier, but also just think about, we have Compton and we have Watts.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I know, it's like, that's right. I mean, that's 10 miles away, maybe, as the crow flies. Have you and I ever gone there in our life? You know, I mean, it's like we drive past it on the freeway, but you and I know if you need gas, don't get off the freeway there to get gas.
Yeah.
That's just stupid.
You know, there was always a pecking order at the surf spots.
Yeah.
At the pipeline or wherever you were, there was a pecking order. And
yeah.
And if you understood that, then everything went smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a difference watching the name guys out there surf than the guys who wanted to make a name for themselves. And the only reason I know this is because I was on the outside looking and watching these guys surf. And, you know, the top name guys out there, they wouldn't take off on a wave that wasn't absolutely the best wave.
Right.
And they knew they knew by looking at it which wave was going to do what.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty impressive to watch that.
You talk about the North Shore like an outsider looking in. Did you ever feel like you were an insider there?
I don't feel like I'm an insider anywhere.
Really?
Yeah, I just...
Among the world of board builders, you don't feel like an insider?
I think the biggest problem somebody can do, especially in surfboards, is let their ego get in the way of their success.
Okay.
And if I ever thought that I had made it, then I probably wouldn't be achieving the few things that I am at this age.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to me what my peers think about me, what other people think about me. I don't give a shit.
Yeah. Who do you view as your peers?
Anybody who has ever done something in surfing, for surfing or for surfboards, who are still humble to this day and still trying to achieve great things.
Right.
It's funny. I got an email last night from Pat Rawson, and he was congratulating me on my second win at the Icons of Foam. And that's very uplifting to me, that a guy like Pat Rawson, we're friends, but he would waste 2 minutes of his life to send me an email congratulating me. And he said some nice things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you turn the clock back 7 or 8 years, Pat was in California and he was at my house where I was doing a board for, I forget, Pat was dropping off something and I was going to help him out.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a glass job. And he had just won the Brewer tribute to Dick Brewer, I believe. And he actually said, you know, Roger, you should get in these. I think you would do okay in them.
What Roger's referring to Pat Rawson speaking about is the Icons of Foam shaping competition, which I mentioned at the top of the show. Basically, it's the focal point of the boardroom show, and it's a shaping competition where they select one iconic surfboard design from history and give a 90-minute window and a few select tools to the shaping contestants, and they attempt to recreate that iconic surfboard. 3 years ago, the Icons of Foam honoree was the recently passed Terry Martin, who happened to be a really good friend and colleague of Roger's.
When I was out of the business for the 4 years, and when I got back in and found out that, I knew that Terry Martin had passed away because I was at the deal for him, and but they had done a tribute to Terry at the Icons of Foam. I was thinking, man, I sure would like to have been in that, because I glassed a lot of boards that he had shaped, and I thought that I would probably be able to do pretty well in that. And just to honor Terry would have been just a great moment.
Well, we're talking about peers. What was your relationship with Terry?
He was a great man. I worked down at Hobie's, and he had worked there most of all of his life, but I'd worked there in the back, and him and I kept about the same hours. We would just show up and work, and he would come in every day with a smile on his face. He was in the 70s, and he'd handshake, I don't know, 7-10 boards a day.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it was nothing.
Yeah.
Just like, and they were all the same.
Right.
Just amazing.
Like a machine.
Just amazing how hard he worked at that age and made it look like it was really easy.
Yeah.
It was really inspiring.
It seems like the people who you respect most or that you view as your peers or that you would appreciate those compliments from, like Pat, don't so much have to do with what they've achieved in their career. It more has to do with just their work output, like how their work ethic, I guess. Like if they're plugging away every day, just doing it, grinding it out, you know, it seems like that's something that you value. It's hard work.
I do, and I also value that people who are famous like that treat people who aren't famous as an equal.
Right.
In the surf world, that doesn't happen.
Right.
And it's a crime that a lot of the people in this business act as if they walk on water.
Yeah.
When in fact, for the most part, they can't push a planer around a board.
Right. Well, it does seem that way, that there's an element of celebrity in surfing because it's glam, or it's, I don't know, it's sexy to the outside world looking in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. There's guys who, for whatever reason, get a little bit of juice. And they can live off that juice, you know, or the hype or whatever. But there's a huge disparity. There's a lot of people who are unsung heroes, like real quality craftsmen who don't have a bone in their body in terms of interest in celebrity.
You know, I'm grateful for everything. I'm grateful for that I'm be able to healthy to where I can get back in the surfboard business and build surfboards.
Yeah.
I love building surfboards. I love going surfing. And that allows it. I mean, I could make a lot more money doing other things, but this is what I really like at the end of the day.
Let me ask you about kind of making money off of surfboards, because you've experienced it over the course of 40 years,
mm-hmm.
I guess, and in different areas too, the North Shore, and you've traveled a bit to do it.
Mm-hmm.
How equitable was it in the 70s on the North Shore to make a living off of building boards? And how has it evolved over time, and how is it different today?
It hasn't. I think in 1974, I was getting paid $10 to sand a board with a glass on fin or a box.
And how long would that take?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember.
I mean, is it $10 an hour, essentially, or 10 bucks?
It wouldn't take an hour, you know, okay. maybe 35, 40 minutes.
Okay.
But in today's, and this was in 1974, when we had a house across from the beach for $300 a month, a three-bedroom house, which we shared. Now, in 2015, I think sanders are making $22 or $25, and that same house, you're not going to get across the street from the beach for less than probably about $3,000 a month. So, no, it's
so the wages doubled and the inflation is like,
yeah,
multiplied times 10.
Everybody knows that surfboards are underpriced, but it's funny. I used to think, why are they selling their boards for so cheap? And I was glassing some boards for Dale Velzy. He had some overflow boards in the late 80s, I think, early 90s. I was glassing some boards for him. And he would tell me, you know, don't worry about it, kid. Everybody wants to give boards away. You're always going to have the guy coming into the business that wants to give a board away so he can make surfboards.
Right.
So if you do a really good job and charge the money you feel necessary to make that project happen, you're going to have more work than you know what to do with.
Yes.
You don't have to pigeonhole yourself as the low guy. And so I got that over that really quick when he said that. I was just like, okay, well, from the beginning, it's been like that. So
there was always...
always somebody who wants to undercut somebody to get in the business or...
But also always somebody who's willing to pay a premium for a premium product.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
In emerging surfboard markets, there's a reverence for talented shapers from Hawaii and California. And rather than shipping a container of 100 surfboards across the ocean, it's often cheaper to purchase a plane ticket for that shaper and hire them to come build those 100 surfboards on location. Rogers benefited from this exchange and has been able to travel the globe with his planer and surf exotic locations while on the clock.
I've been to Japan a lot. I don't glass boards while I'm in Japan. Usually I just go there and shape. And I can be there from 2 weeks to a month, whatever it is, to do however many boards is necessary. I just pack up a suitcase full of tools and throw my templates in a snowboard bag, and off I go. And then I was in South America, in Brazil. I was there for quite a while. What a great place.
Really?
Oh, man. I had so much fun surfing there. There's good waves there a lot. I was in a place called Macumba. And it's like giant Bolsa Chica. It's just big peaks bringing way out. It's just such a great wave. So much fun. And I was working at a factory that a pro surfer from the 70s from Brazil, Daniel Freeman. He owns it, and he had it was a big compound. He had his house on the property, and it shaping rooms, glassing, everything was right there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good time.
So how does that work? I mean, from a business standpoint, I assume they pay your travel expenses, fly you down, and then do they pay you just per board? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Basically, they get you a ticket, and they put you up and feed you the whole time.
Cool.
And then they just pay you a price per board, whatever you've worked out in advance.
Okay.
And that was a good time. I was down there a couple times.
Yeah.
And I just get up every morning and go surf and then walk to work and then try to surf again in the afternoon. But
yeah.
Good time. Brazil's got some great waves.
Yeah.
A little dicey, though. Sometimes there's no buffer from the rich to the poor. And I didn't experience anything, but I heard stories that you really have to be careful.
Sure.
But I didn't experience anything but a good time.
Right.
Again, I kind of flew under the radar and
yeah,
didn't make a big deal. I
right.
just went surfing, and if a wave came to me, I took it.
Right.
If somebody was there, I'd let them have it.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. Seems like plenty to go around, too, back in the day.
Yeah. And then I was in Italy. That was an interesting trip because I was in Brazil. I was in Brazil for about a month, and my wife called me and said, hey, you got to go to Italy to shape in this show in Florence. And I'm in Brazil. I'm just going, I can't leave. I'm here working. So anyway, push came to shove. So I think I had done 100 boards in Brazil, and I had to do another 50, but I had to go. So I came back here for like 3 days, and off I went. And I got to Italy, and I was working for, it was the Bear label, and it was inside this really old castle in Florence. You walk through a drawbridge, and then inside this was all these booths set up, and it was the biggest clothing show, trade show in Europe. It was called Petit, I think. We might have to look up the spelling on that.
Okay.
Petit show. Huge. I mean, I don't know how many people were there. Huge. And I was inside this glass shaping room. And I just sat in there and shaped all day.
Crazy.
And there would be people walking up and watching. I was in that thing all day. I don't know, 6 days.
Wow.
And then they shot me up to Genoa, which is close to the border of France. And did some promotional stuff up there. And then I went back to Rome. And I actually shaped in Rome. They have a factory in Rome out by the airport.
Okay.
And I was told that there was a right point out there. You know, the low pressures come off of France and swing down the Mediterranean, so it's swell.
Yeah. Did you surf at all when you were there?
In Genoa, they were surfing one day. It was not real good. I was just there doing some promotional stuff, so I just threw on some shorts and swam out there and just body surfed a couple just to be part of the action, but
right.
I didn't surf.
Yeah. Fascinating.
It was a really fascinating trip.
Huh.
There's a surfing population.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a film that came out last year that kind of documents some of that.
So I was doing a lot of licensing projects at the time. I was doing Dewey Weber's, my own label. It was a course of about, I don't know, through a lot of the 90s, I did licensing projects. I did the Blue Hawaii, Russ K. Makaha. Built a lot of boards for the guys in Hawaii. Would ship them from here, build them here and ship them.
Can you explain how licensing works?
Well, for the Dewey Weber deal, Carolyn came to me and asked if I would be interested in doing the project. So yeah, we put together some models, and she obviously had a following. You know, Weber is a big name.
Sure.
If he would have lived, I mean, Jesus, there wouldn't have been a bigger longboard builder in the world, I don't think. I think he had the biggest name, or would have had. So I would pay a fee. She would sell the boards and hand off the orders to me, and I would build them. And I would pay a fee out of that, and I would get paid for the boards. We'd ship them, and it was fun. It was overwhelming after a while. The boards were really hard to build. They were really high-end boards, and I was really, at the time, the only one in my factory that knew anything about color work or polishes, because it just came out of, in the early 90s, there was no polishes going on to speak of, not a lot.
Yeah.
Or color work, for that matter, transparency. So that kind of got overwhelming after a while. I figured how many boards we're building with my label and her label, and then Blue Hawaii came in. They, Glenn Manami, I started building the boards here in Cal. I was a California licensee. Then over the years, it was Russ K. Makaha. Same deal. You just pay a fee.
Yeah. So rather than Blue Hawaii, like taking orders, shipping the boards over to California, paying all that cost, it's easier just to have you build them here.
Yeah. I was my own entity, to where shops would order boards and I'd make them and pay Glenn a royalty.
Right.
It was funny. One day, I'm working in the factory, and I don't know how many years ago it was. Maybe 94, 95. So 20 years ago. At the time, I thought, wow, this older guy walks in the factory and he's got a backpack. I don't know how old he was at the time. And he asked for me, and I go, I'm him. And he goes, my name is Frederick Wardy, and I wanted to see if you'd be interested in building my label of boards, Fred Wardy Surfboards. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. And at the time, the labels, the older labels from the 60s, that was a big deal. There was a following in Japan for some of them, and here. And so I thought that was pretty cool, but he was a nice man too. We talked several times, but we couldn't work out the deal because he had already promised the clothing part of it to a friend of his, and I wasn't willing to build the boards unless I got the clothing too, because that would make it worth it.
Yeah, sure.
But
well, I mean, the board building is just labor intensive, you know, and
yeah, that was a pretty cool moment. That I think he lives in New York, or I don't know, this is a long time ago.
Yeah,
He was very pleasant, though.
Of course, we are all aware that surfboard construction involves toxic chemicals, and there are a lot of precautions one must exercise if this is your chosen line of work. So you may have heard Roger mention earlier in the show that he took a 4-year hiatus from board building. I'd known this part of Roger's timeline, but I was never quite certain what the reasoning for it was.
When Clark Foam closed, I got my hands on some blanks that I think, after everything was said and done, had some unreacted chemicals in them. And so I started having some health issue after about 3 months into the blanks. And it kind of just freaked me out. And so I just stopped building boards. I sold my factory to Tim Stamps.
Was your ambition to just like get healthy at that point and then return to board building? Or did you just get freaked out and think to yourself, like, I'm out of here permanently, I'm going to retire?
I had so much problem at the time, I thought I got to just get away from this to find out what was the cause of the problem.
Okay.
It could have been me sanding surfboards in the 70s with a paper mask and no shirt.
Sure.
And it could have been, you know, anything. But
or it could have been those new blanks that you were uncertain about.
Yeah.
So was it like respiratory issues or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then about 2 years went by. Now maybe a year. I started feeling, you know, everything's kind of back to normal. Maybe a year and a half. So I went down and started working at Hobie's because I thought, well, I feel pretty good. Why not? And that was 2007. And then in 2010, that's when I was in Brazil for the second time. And then I went off to Italy. And when I got back from Italy, I noticed some lumps on my lymph nodes that weren't there. So then that kind of went, wow, here we go again. So I jumped out of the business again because I thought, oh, shit, that's, I probably should have just stayed out the first time. And then was out for 4 years working construction.
Yeah.
Building, just supporting my wife. And yeah, I was pretty much out of shape. You know, I didn't surf much. And I don't know, about a year and a half ago, I was in Hawaii, staying at Randy's and surfing. And I realized at that time, you know, I'm pretty freaking miserable working construction. And at this age, I should probably do what is going to make me happy.
Yeah.
So I got back in the business. And it just started steamrolling. Looks like I got back in at the right time.
Yeah.
Everybody wants a custom board.
Yeah.
Just as Roger re-entered the business, he was selected to participate in the aforementioned 2014 Icons of Foam tribute to Ben Ipa for his Sting surfboard that Buttons made famous. Ipa and his son were on hand to judge the event, and they deemed Roger the winner. This year, the honoree was Rusty, and the board was Aki's famous 1984 Thruster. Roger, of course, won that event as well, and he did so over Chris Christensen, Tim Stamps, Dave Parmenter, Ward Coffey, and Stu Kenson.
The reason why I was asking about winning the first one, and certainly with this one too, is maybe it doesn't dictate your business so much or change the way you do business, but we were talking about peers and getting validation from peers and just a pat on the back of like, hey, good job. Right. And it is a very industry-driven competition. It doesn't have a huge influence in the market to the general public, right, but everybody in the industry pays attention to it, you know? So I feel like that has to validate your work in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, it working with Rusty, that was pretty interesting. That was not an easy board to shape.
Yeah.
That was not an easy board. There was a lot of stuff going on that board.
Yeah.
He is a 6'5R. That thing has just under a half inch of crown in the deck. And I had to basically shape in reverse. I never shaped the deck of the board first, ever. But there was only 3/4 inch tolerance in this to get to a finished product. So I just started chopping out the deck first thing and just getting it as flat as I could. And then went to the bottom after that. But it worked out well, but it wasn't an easy one to do at all.
Yeah. Let's, if I can re-traumatize you for a couple minutes, let's talk about the Ultimate Craftsman project for 5 minutes.
Wow.
Obviously, the Boardroom Show enlisted 4 guys to build kind of their ultimate expression of a surfboard, whatever they thought that might be. What did you build?
I built a replica outline of a 1967 Skip Frye Gordon & Smith. A really beautiful, beautiful outline on the board. But I put together a checkerboard stringer that had 3,400-year-old Sequoia in it. I had 504 individual pieces. Yeah, that kind of sucked up about 3 months of my life.
Yeah. So I participated in some of that process.
Yes,
and
you
have built a lot of like checkerboard tail blocks in the past, essentially.
Yeah.
So you had an idea to recreate that, but in the full length of the stringer, right?
Yeah, I had an idea in my head, but I had no idea how hard it was going to be. And actually, right when I bought the wood, which was not cheap, my wife asked me, she goes, "Do you think you can glue that thing up?" And I go, "I have no idea." But I think a lot of things in life, you don't have to know how you're going to get from point A to point B. You just got to get moving past point A, and it's going to unfold. I think it's going to unfold. And it did. I just glued up a bunch of wood and started chopping at it, and it was a learning curve, but it went well. Yeah, it was a beautiful board.
So you got, how do you acquire 3,400-year-old wood? And I know sequoias are protected, you know, as part of the California park system or whatever.
Yeah, so this was a fallen tree that a mill in Sacramento had, and Josh Martin had told me about it. And so I got a hold of them and inquired, and my first hurdle was not so much how much the wood was. I didn't even care what that was. It was, I needed a certificate of authenticity showing the age of the wood.
Okay.
To me, that was the most important thing. There's a lot of old growth redwood out there. Not a lot, but 3,400 year, that kind of stuck in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were able to supply me with that, I just went ahead and bought it.
Okay.
And just started milling it.
And obviously, so you got the checkerboard stringer, and then you incorporated that into the fin as well.
Yeah.
So you've got this 68 Skip Frye kind of longboard with this one-of-a-kind unique stringer. Had you ever seen a stringer like that before?
Not all the way through the board. I know that there was some checkerboard veneers in boards before.
Okay.
A lot of boards that had the fancy stringer work in them in the 60s, like a Greg Knoll figure eight stringer, a lot of those were just routed in and veneered in, maybe a half inch. They weren't all the way through the board. But this was actually the first one that I have seen or heard about that went all the way through the board.
Mm-hmm.
I glued up 9'6" of 6-inch tall stringer.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed for me to catch the rocker at both ends.
Okay.
6 inches.
And
I used the 9'8" Y. I think the finished rocker I used on that was maybe a 5.5 nose, 5.25 nose or something like that. So there was plenty of room there to work with.
Sure. And how much of that stringer is strictly aesthetic, and how much are you anticipating any sort of flex dynamic in it, or is it solely aesthetic?
Yeah, it's only there for looks, because it You know, it has T-bands on the on both sides of it, which would stiffen it up and strengthen it, but there's no flex involved in that in my brain.
Yeah.
I was just trying to put it together and keep it indexed because it was called the Ultimate Craftsman. I just wanted to show something from beginning to end that somebody took a raw material and milled it, mm-hmm. glued it, mm-hmm. shaped it, and glassed it.
Who's going to end up with that board? Are you looking to sell it, or are you... I would assume that you've received a lot of interest at the show from people who would be interested in something like that. What are your plans with the board?
Well, I made a decision to build three boards like that or similar to that, but the stringer is what is the focal point. I can build a gun out of it using that same stringer. I can build a nose rider out of it, but everything is based around that stringer.
Right.
So I'm only going to build three, and one is already built in 2015. And then in 2016, I'm going to build three of something new.
Got it.
And then 17, three of something new. And yeah, so they will be for sale and available.
So kind of do a limited run, limited edition. A customer could have one of three of this 2015 project. And from a collector standpoint, then maybe get one of 2015 next year, get one of 2016, get the 2017 sort of an idea.
Exactly. And they won't be the same next year as the checkerboard stringer would just be for this year only.
Right.
There's only a limited amount of that wood.
Right.
I also thought about maybe next year not doing a checkerboard, but turning it on a diamond.
Oh.
Which is going to be a lot more labor intensive and possibly doing a couple offset stringers. I think that something like that would really look nice on a gun. You know, it's kind of endless if I'd be open for ideas too.
Yeah. Interesting. So if somebody wants to acquire the one of three, I'm sure there's already been a lot of inquiries. If somebody wants to acquire the one of three, how do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can just go to the website and get a hold of me there. Roger at Roger Hines Surfboards. Yeah, you know, it's a unique board, so it's not for everybody. It's a rider, number one, but I don't know how bad somebody wants to pay a significant amount of money for a board to ride in the ocean, but I would love to do that.
Yeah. Well, you shaped another board that was basically a replica of this, but without the checkerboard stringer, yep. And you and I have each ridden it.
Yeah.
Thing works beautifully.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
So it's kind of like, I guess if they wanted to, they could buy the more expensive checkerboard version if they wanted to have a wall hanger collectible type piece. And if you actually want to ride the board, buy one with a bass stringer in it or whatever.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, because we did that one the same day. We built them both the same time.
Yeah.
So they were built
Side by side.
So yeah, that one rides really well.
Yeah. With Roger's reemergence into the industry and following the success of his first Icons of Foam win, Roger built a new factory from scratch. Just a couple miles from his hometown of Seal Beach, California, Roger used his 40 years of experience shaping around the world to engineer precision lighting, ventilation, racks, and just overall space to create and fulfill his work.
It's kind of a dream factory. There's a lot of room in here. My wife has an office where she can do the website and sell T-shirts and take care of business. And it's I have everything in here. I'm shaping room, sanding, polishing everything. It's a nice working. It's a good working environment. The temperature stays mid-70s in here pretty much all the time. It's a concrete building.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pleasant area to gloss. It's nice.
And that should be stated. I mean, the board, you build the board from beginning to end.
Yeah, right? Every one of them. I hand shape everything. And, you know, I forget. Somebody asked me a few days ago if I was ever on the shaping computer. I was in the early 90s. We were doing 1,000 boards a year back then. And I was earlier on when there wasn't a lot of guys on it, I think I did two or three months of the Shaping Computer. And good or bad, it wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. It just didn't work for my needs. But I think the bigger companies who are producing, like Lost or Rusty or CI, I mean, you couldn't do your business without a computer.
Right.
I mean, you have to have, the same board over and over and over, no matter what. And so I think the bigger companies need it, but it's not for me. I hand shape and glass everything myself.
Yeah. Excellent. What's your current relationship like with surfing? How often do you surf?
Well, I still try to surf every day, but this is kind of a crappy time of year to be a surfer in California. I still try to surf every day, depending upon my workload.
Yeah. What was the last surfboard that you rode?
It was a board that I made when I was in Brazil in 2010 for a team guy, Shaped and Glassed in Rio, and he came through California about 6 months ago to pick up some new boards, and I kept this thing. And it was a 9.4, kind of a longboard gun. Rides well. So I rode it last Friday or Saturday I was out.
Cool. RogerHinesSurfboards.com is his website, and of course, SurfSplendorPodcast.com is our website. We'll have images of Roger and a lot of his boards that he discussed in today's show. And then, of course, if you ever order a board from Roger, they're made with his two hands from beginning to end. All right. Thank you for tuning in. I hope that you enjoyed today's show. This is David Scales for Surf Splendor, reminding you to shred on. Champagne.